From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week's Republican National Convention in Tampa was kind of fascinating in that it showed mainstream journalists struggling to reconcile reporting on blatant untruth with their reflexive aversion to taking stands. Presidential nominee Mitt Romney mostly steered clear of provable facts, as in his reference to the president's, quote, apology tour. Fact-checking organizations call that untrue, but what if you equate diplomacy with apology? Likewise, if he asserts,
I wish President Obama had succeeded because I want America to succeed.
I mean, who's to argue? But vice presidential nominee Paul Ryan's speech, praised as audacious and energetic, was so factually challenged that Fox News anchor Chris Wallace was moved to offer a couple of fast, preemptive fact checks.
I just want to make two final points because they're going to be brought up over the course of the next 24 hours. He talked about the GM plant in Janesville that was shut down after Obama came in. I'm sure the Democrats are going to point out it was the president who bailed out GM. And he also criticized the president for doing nothing about the Bowles-Simpson plan. He was a member of the Bowles-Simpson Commission, and he voted against it. Back to you, Megan.
To his credit, Wallace was quick on the draw. On cable and broadcast TV, Ryan's whoppers were generally referenced fleetingly as statements that Democrats might later dispute, suggesting that no fact is nonpartisan. True, CNN did provide a video crawl during the speech and the following days with the word fact in red type. Since we can't show you that, we made you an audio version.
For my part, your nomination is
fact.
An unexpected
Jana
term.
Ryan and her husband have
it
three children,
news to my family.
Liza, Charlie, and Sam.
And I'd like you to meet them. My best friend and wife, Jana,
fact.
Our
Paul Ryan
Liza,
was born in Janesville,
boys,
Wisconsin.
Sam.
He has a BA from Miami University in Ohio.
Fact.
Mitt Romney is watching Paul Ryan's speech
Governor Romney
in
asked
his
me to
hotel
join the
room
ticket, I said,
with family.
Let's get this done. There she is, my
fact.
Mom, Betty.
Paul Ryan is a congressman from Wisconsin.
The people of Wisconsin have been good to me.
Fact.
My dad,
Paul Ryan's
a small
father
town
died
lawyer,
when he was,
also
15
named Paul.
Years
until
old.
Until we lost him when I was 16.
Oops.
I'd like to think he'd be proud
fact.
Of me.
Paul Ryan and his wife
and
have
brothers.
Three children.
Facts, ma'am. But as for fact-checking Ryan's claims with regard to, say, the stimulus package, that was either too hard, you'd need to Google, or too risky. And so instead, we read that he had three kids twice in the same recurring cycle. Meanwhile, a Romney strategist says he won't be dictated to by fact checkers. That in reference to a political ad we'll get to in a few minutes. And the Obama campaign sent a public letter of complaint earlier this summer to factcheck.org when that organization found untruths in its ad about Romney and Bain. So the game is on. If the campaigns can't be shamed into probity, what are the media to do? Try harder. And James Fallows of The Atlantic says they are, despite a natural inclination not to.
I think that in a way, the creation of the fact-checker meme over the last decade or so in journalism reflects a mismatch between the approach of conventional journalists and some of the evolving realities of politics, because conventional journalists, as we both know, are most comfortable when they can say, critics say X, and yet the administration denies X. Because it's awkward for them to say, the administration says Z, and Z is not true, it's been easier to franchise that duty to some other part of the same organization who could say, well, here, wearing my fact-checker referee hat, I can say that this claim is not actually true. It took that burden away from the normal reporter.
Poor journalists.
Poor journalists.
But now the fact-checking institutions themselves are under attack.
If most journalists realize that we're operating in a world in which some major political figures are not going to be constrained by saying things that are just not true, then maybe that will become part of our news reporting again, as I think it should have been. And we have seen some little signs of that, of headlines in major papers saying, you know, candidate X falsely says this, or political ad Z falsely claims that.
We were really stunned by how slow the fact-checking was on the cable networks and on the broadcast networks, even the post-game analysis the next morning.
That is interesting. It may be on TV, the main way in which people feel comfortable expressing their opinions is sort of sports commentary play-by-play. Mm-hmm. That was an effective speech. He looked tired. The crowd was responding. All those things we know about the kind of sports journalism aspect of politics. It could also be that different sorts of skills are selected for in TV broadcasters versus people who are expressing themselves through writing. And again, I'm looking on the glasses one-tenth full perspective. Compared with a year or two ago, there's more willingness in more parts of the press now to try to deal with a basically changed fact environment. So that's at least movement in the correct direction.
James, you move me. You really think that if we repeat it long enough as journalists, it will make a difference? I mean, what if everybody knows that something is a lie and nobody gives a crap?
I will answer this in two ways with actual earnestness. My father was a doctor. He knew that everybody he was going to treat would eventually die. But he did his best to make their life as healthy and as prolonged as it could be, et cetera. So part of what one does is to work along in the face sometimes of inevitable failure or defeat. The other answer would be that unless we thought that it made some difference to repeat that something is true and something else is false, why would you or I stay in this business one more day? Why not go open a beer hall?
Jim Fallows of The Atlantic. Jim, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Brooke.
So have we well and truly reached the point when, contrary to Daniel Patrick Moynihan's famous dictum, we are entitled to our own facts?
President Obama quietly announced a plan to gut welfare reform by dropping work requirements. Under Obama's plan, you wouldn't have to work and wouldn't have to train for a job. They just send you your welfare check.
The Romney camp has called this its most effective ad. But PolitiFact awarded it a pants-on-fire rating for deception. The Washington Post fact-checker gave it 4 Pinocchios. And fact-checkers have also found the Obama response to the ad, accusing Romney of being two-faced on the issue, false as well. That got 3 Pinocchios. Former New Hampshire Governor John Sununu this week nominated Mitt Romney for president at the Republican National Convention. We couldn't get anyone from the Romney campaign, so we called on him to give us his insight on what's going on.
With all due respect to the, quote, fact checkers that have called that ad wrong, they don't know what they're talking about. Let me explain to you why they're wrong. That law was written specifically by a Republican Congress to make sure that a governor could not get waivers from the work component. President Clinton vetoed it twice over that provision that prohibited allowing anybody to grant waivers on the work component. The fact checkers just don't know what they're talking about. I, as a governor, was part of the process that led up to this, with the National Governors Association on a bipartisan basis having Republican governors and Democratic governors lobbying for this kind of stuff. And what has been done by the memo from Health and Human Services that has gone out there literally begging governors to ask for waivers on the workfare component is gutting the process. And if the president says that's not true, once again, the president of the United States is lying.
What you said to Wolf Blitzer was you want to avoid language that encourages or permits people to do soft self-studies or look for work on the internet instead of going to an employer.
That's correct.
Under the waivers, in some cases that could happen. Given how cash-strapped a lot of these states are, it's unlikely. But in any case,
the fact that you now acknowledge that that can happen after the law was written to prohibit permitting that to happen, you have underscored what Mitt Romney is saying. The President of the United States has broken the law by extending waiver capacity for things that were deliberately excluded by the people who wrote the law, and everything else is irrelevant.
However shady the Obama administration may have been by calling for this waiver under one provision of the bill as opposed to another provision where the waivers are banned, I concede this was not a very proper process in any way. It is still a long way from that to the assertion that you wouldn't have to train for a job. They just send you your welfare check.
It allows them to go in that direction in violation of the restriction of the law that said they could not go that far. And that's the whole point. It is what governors, Republican and Democrats, felt had to be done to deal with the welfare needs of the country. And as Rick Santorum pointed out last night, what it has done is increased work for those who in the past never had hopes to getting work. It provided the real training for them and the real entree into the workplace. And for this president to gut it that way is unconscionable.
This is the problem when everyone has the right to their own facts.
Ma'am, you weren't involved in writing the law. Rick Santorum was. You weren't involved in writing the law. Speaker Gingrich was. You weren't involved in fighting to make sure that a provision for waivers was not in the law. These people were, and they have attested to the fact, and all the weasel wording that comes out of the President of the United States and NPR is not going to change those facts. I've enjoyed being on the air. I've got to go to my next call.
Why didn't the ad refer to waivers rather than no longer having to work? Why not say what it is the president actually did?
If you say that the ad is perfectly right with adding waivers, then you're acknowledging the fact that the president broke the law.
I think the ad
waivers.
Is wrong.
As usual, you, part of the liberal press that will cover this president's butt across the board, you're going to lose in November. But I've enjoyed talking to you. Thank you.
That was former New Hampshire Governor John Sununu. It's true, as he said, I didn't write the welfare law he claims the president gutted. Republican legislators like Newt Gingrich did. Newt Gingrich repeated the gutting welfare line at the Republican National Convention, but here he is a little earlier with Anderson Cooper.
You do think that the actual wording under Obama's plan, you wouldn't have to train for a job, they just send you a welfare check, that is not factually correct.
We have no proof today, but I would say to you, under Obama's ideology, it is absolutely true that he would be comfortable sending a lot of people checks for doing nothing.
Coming up, is Florida really as weird as it seems? This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. And now for something completely different. In January, Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown and his Democratic challenger Elizabeth Warren agreed to the People's Pledge, a voluntary enforcement scheme designed to banish super PAC and special interest advertising from their campaigns. The deal goes like this. If an outside group runs a spot, the candidate who benefits from that ad promises to donate half the ad's cost to a charity of the opposing candidate's choice. To the amazement of campaign watchers everywhere, thus far, it has worked. John Carroll, a mass communications professor at Boston University, has been following the campaign. John, welcome to On the Media.
Nice to be here.
The race is neck and neck, and anywhere else in the country, you'd be seeing wall-to-wall super PAC ads. Is this pledge making a difference in Massachusetts?
It is making a difference in a number of different ways. One is that there's more money going to the campaigns, because anyone who wants to support either Brown or Warren, who otherwise could give money to a super PAC, is really restricted to giving money directly to the campaign. So that's one thing. The other thing is that there's not as much smash-mouth advertising on the air as there is in other states.
The ones where the color bleaches out and there's a dramatic bass note?
No, they're missing. For instance, there was a rumpus here about Elizabeth Warren's Native American heritage and whether she actually had Native American heritage or not. Scott Brown can't go after Elizabeth Warren on that topic. He just can't do it.
The charge was that she was exaggerating her Native American background.
Right, that she had fabricated it, actually, and had used it to her advantage, to her professional advantage in the academic world. Now, if third-party ads were running here in the state, you can imagine what Karl Rove's group, Crossroads GPS, might do with that topic. But they haven't. So it's been left to the Boston Herald to whack Elizabeth Warren around as much as possible on that topic. But Scott Brown is in this sort of delicate position where he can't really go negative without risking blowback. You know, Scott Brown has always built himself as an independent voice. He's someone who doesn't want to be beholden to the interest groups associated with the Republican Party. Elizabeth Warren, I mean, this plays into her image as a goo-goo. She's basically a good government type. So I think both of them, it plays to their strengths as candidates to stick with this pledge.
How do you think this is going to end?
Okay, so there are two schools of thought here. One is that if a wide enough lead opens up between the two candidates, the one who is trailing will have third-party groups coming in to help them close that gap. The second school of thought is that this will survive because the candidates will be afraid to break it, be afraid to alienate the public, and that they have enough money to wage a robust campaign without the third-party groups coming in. So I think a lot is going to happen after Labor Day, and a lot's going to be determined by whether this race stays tight or this race opens up and makes one candidate desperate enough to break the pledge.
That one candidate, I assume, would be Scott Brown because there's so much more super PAC money behind the Republicans.
The Democratic super PACs have pretty much lunch money compared to the Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
So what you have is a situation where Scott Brown would be hugely advantaged by this pledge being broken. But I'm not sure that he wants to run the risk of being the one to break it.
And you think the public will care?
I think the public cares about this pledge the same way the public says they watch a lot of public television. I think that in theory, they like it. But if it went away, they would grumble about the ads. But I don't think there would be any permanent damage.
Do you think that the People's Pledge could gain steam elsewhere?
Other candidates are going to look at the situation in Massachusetts and think this will never be a sort of even-Steven deal. One candidate, one campaign is going to be disadvantaged by this in almost every case. And so for that reason, I think that most candidates will stay away from it.
So if you think a likely scenario is Karl Rove's Crossroads super PAC moving in at some point, what would you wager?
If I'm betting with my money, I think that I would probably hedge my bet a little bit. I think that there is a chance that this pledge will survive all the way to Election Day. I think that there are many factors that could make it fall apart. There's only one real factor that keeps it together, which is the candidates protecting their images.
John, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
John Carroll is a professor of mass communications at Boston University. Sheldon Adelson, the casino magnate who's vowed to support Mitt Romney's presidential run with as much as $100 million, was at the Republican National Convention, where his wife was honored with a woman-themed pavilion. Adelson has also made news in every sense in the Middle East. 5 years ago, using some small portion of his wealth, now estimated at about $25 billion, he launched a newspaper in Israel called Israel Hayam, or Israel Today. The free paper, aggressively supportive of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, is now the nation's most popular daily, thriving while its competitors downsize and slash jobs. Jerusalem-based reporter Matthew Kalman wrote about Israel Hayam in the New York Daily News. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hello, Brooke.
In your Daily News piece, you quote a senior editor from Israel's former leading paper, and he accuses Adelson of destroying the competition in the Israeli newspaper industry.
This is what he said. Israel Today is destroying Israeli journalism, not only at the professional level with its embarrassing editorial conduct, but also at the economic level. So what he's basically arguing is that by pouring money into a non-commercial operation, Adelson is simply destroying the existing business model for newspapers, and nobody else can compete.
Newspapers are a dying business, and what's happening right now in Israel could arguably be natural attrition.
There's no doubt at all that even before Adelson came along, internet penetration into the market had already begun to cause a decline. But the issue is particularly sensitive here. It's not very long, only about 30 years, since the Israeli media was completely government-controlled. Since then, the press has been completely liberated from these kind of political shackles. So attempt to manipulate Israeli politics through the media by someone who not only doesn't live in the country, he doesn't even speak the language of the country, is something that Israelis find very distasteful.
There is something vaguely Murdochian about some of this. Rupert Murdoch has had an impact on American discourse through the Fox News Network. But there's a difference between Murdoch, the head of News Corp, and how Adelson is running Israel Today.
I see a difference, certainly. Now, I was living in Britain when Murdoch made his large investments in his flagship newspapers there. And I very clearly recall Murdoch switching the support of his newspapers from the conservative government of John Major to the incoming Labour government of Tony Blair. And Murdoch is widely credited with helping to swing that vote that brought Tony Blair to power. Murdoch still had business interests in his mind when he was directing the editorial stance of his newspapers. It's impossible to imagine Adelson not supporting Benjamin Netanyahu, whatever he decides to do. And that, I think, is the difference.
So the paper is devoted to the furtherance of Benjamin Netanyahu. Does it do so at the expense of the facts?
I would say that they reserve their most vicious editorial attacks for anyone who dares to disagree with or criticize Netanyahu and the government. I wouldn't say that they do that at the expense of the truth, but the journalists who work there know that they have to toe a particular editorial line in anything that touches the government. There isn't even a pretense of objectivity, and that makes them very, very different to any other paper in Israel. It's known as the Bibiton, which is Hebrew for sort of BB News.
Mm-hmm. And BB being Netanyahu's nickname.
Exactly. And that's how it's perceived here.
You know, Matthew, in the big scheme of things, people seek out the media that accords with their views. Over 50% of the country does support Netanyahu. How much of that can you really attribute to Adelson and his newspaper?
Well, let me quote Nahum Barnea, who's an award-winning Israeli columnist. He described the paper, which was launched just before the last election, as the biggest election gift ever given in Israel. If you remember, Netanyahu was elected by a knife edge, so any slight swing in the vote there was extremely important. The other thing about Israel is that the standard of living here is much, much lower than it is in the States, and so an expenditure on a daily newspaper is much, much higher proportionally. Salaries are about a third of what they are in the States. If someone's giving you a newspaper for nothing instead of one that you have to pay for, then it's going to be very attractive to you. And once you start reading it, then I think there's more than likely possibility that it's going to start to inform your political views. I can't prove that, but it seems to me that in the context of Israeli politics and Israeli society, that really is a very definite possibility.
Matthew, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Matthew Kalman is a freelance reporter based in Jerusalem. Republicans held their convention in the swing state of Florida this week. The convention in Tampa was a scripted, predictable affair, but if press coverage is any guide, the state of Florida is anything but. It's a museum of the weird that just happens to have a lot of electoral votes. There's the report of a medical examiner who got behind on her autopsies and decided to store human remains in a storage unit. There's the owner of a creationist-themed amusement park who claimed he didn't have to pay taxes because God was his employer. This month, a recently released inmate was rearrested for trying to steal a car in the jail parking lot. Reporter Will Greenlee covers the crime beat for Scripps Treasure Coast newspapers in Florida and writes the Off the Beat blog for the papers, a compendium of the odd.
Florida does have a reputation for being a home for misfits, but I also think that a lot of it is due to the open records laws in Florida. They're very liberal. It's very easy to get access to arrest affidavits and police reports, and it's part of my job.
So let's assume that Florida has laid itself bare where other states haven't. What about the preponderance of stories that I saw on your site about people who were putting different meat products down their pants?
I've written about Delmonico steaks and pork tenderloin, tuna, salmon, shrimp, all kinds of shellfish in people's pants. A woman was being questioned by the police, and they had found cocaine in her pants pockets. And she said, well, you know, I just bought these pants at Walmart. It must have been in there when I bought the pants.
Do you love your job?
I do. It's very fun.
Do you know who else loves your job?
Who?
Jon Stewart. He said so this week. He was speaking to Marco Rubio on The Daily Show, which was filming in Tampa.
Well, I read the Florida papers mostly.
Yeah,
well,
I do too, mostly. Some of them anyways.
I only read them for the police blotter. It's just... a python ate a cat. Like, I've stuff I've
no,
never...
Yeah, come on.
An alligator dragged two cows...
We've got plenty of papers that have won Pulitzer Prizes for investigative reporting and
about
good stuff.
Cat disappearances.
I don't know. I've never been a crime reporter anywhere else, but I don't think I would like to be one anywhere else. The stuff here is just too good.
Well, thanks again.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Will Greenlee covers the crime beat for Scripps Treasure Coast newspapers. Karen Russell is a native Floridian. Her novel Swamplandia tells the story of a family of alligator wrestlers whose park is threatened by the appearance of a new corporate competitor, the World of Darkness Park. In 2012, Swamplandia was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Karen is here to talk about her mythic home state. Welcome to the show.
I'm happy to. I love talking about weird Florida. It's like my favorite thing to do.
So how do you go about writing fiction about a place that seems at times like a fiction?
This is a real tricky challenge, I think. Things come in over the AP that are much stranger and more troubling than anything you could invent in fiction. So I think one of the advantages of setting fiction there is that readers arrive to the state already prepared to suspend all disbelief.
And are they able to tell what you're deriving from the reality and what you've made up in your head?
What was so interesting about doing a book tour of this particular book was the different kind of regional responses. So I would go to California, say, you know, they'd be like, oh, what a lushly imagined, et cetera. Whereas in Florida, the feeling I often had was an anxiety that I had, like, maybe inadvertently plagiarized someone's true life and was going to go to court. You know, like, I was like, there's going to be litigation.
So in your view, why is Florida so strange?
That's a question for the ages. Like, in the Northeast, everybody cycles through the seasons. That must be doing some important psychological action for people. Because in Florida, you're just bathed in sort of this unchanging summer light all the time.
But Californians have pretty consistent weather.
Well, look at that state, huh? I mean, exactly. I think you've just proven my point.
Also, you grew up in Miami-Dade, a fairly recently staked territory, isn't it?
I think in the 1900s, there were like 8 people on Miami-Dade's county rolls or something. I mean, it was a real frontier, which I think people forget because you think that the West, you know, manifest destiny, that was our pioneer frontier. There's also this real elasticity that comes from a community of people that are pretty recent arrivals. I mean, Florida, it's just the shape of it, too. It's like a lot of strangeness just travels down the spine of the country and seems to land there. Like, I think there's some physics to it.
Yeah, talk a little bit about the peninsularity of Florida.
I also, you know, had no sense that this was particularly a strange place to grow up as a kid because all of our travels were road trips, and Florida's so long that you can never escape it. It's sort of like a B-horror movie state where you drive for 8 hours and you're still in Florida, impossibly. So we'd, like, make it up to Tallahassee. I'm like, yep, everything checks out, pretty normal. Like, I really didn't have a lot of reference points. We used to also go on these field trips to the Miami Museum of Science, and mm-hmm. they had kind of like a wilderness area. You go outside and you can see spiders and lizards and snakes. And it was always completely unclear what was part of the exhibit and what was just kind of chilling on a trash can. Like, I'd be like, is that tarantula the exhibit or just kind of around?
So what's your favorite real weird story about Florida?
There was this field trip. A bunch of Broward kids were going to do a fake archaeological dig. And they're real cute. They're like seventh graders. And they're wearing Indiana Jones hats. And they have little shovels and stuff. And they go out to this marshy area to do their pretend archaeological dig. And like some of the kids found a toe, which led to a real human body. So I think something about that, all of Florida is somehow captured there, where it's like a fake archaeological dig that leads to the discovery and exhumation of a true body.
Okay, so Florida got a lot of coverage this week. Mm-hmm. It's going to be getting a lot more over the next few months. Most of it will be election stories, but I know that some national news outlets will take time to give us the latest weird Florida news. Mm-hmm. So when that happens, will you be embarrassed?
I think it's the way you feel about your family, where sure, I mean, you wish, you know, you wish your uncle was wearing pants or whatever. I mean, you're a little embarrassed.
I hate when that happens.
you feel a lot of love and affection at the same time for the very eccentric things that are likely to be repugnant or frightening to non-family members.
Karen, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Karen Russell is the author of Swamplandia. Coming up, more stuff you wouldn't or shouldn't believe, especially Nigerian scams, and yet, strangely, we still do. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at MelvilleTrust.org. And the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence. At thescanfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. When TV news wasn't dutifully trying to jazz up the Republican convention this week, it was striving to dramatize something already pretty dramatic: Hurricane Isaac. What Jon Stewart on Wednesday night called
hurricane porn. From your standard guy outside in the rain, to women in rain burqa standing under the gutter of Damocles, to guy about to be sucked out to the sea.
But it's not just hurricanes that TV news finds visually irresistible. It's also been a devastating year for wildfires.
An aggressive, almost continuous aerial assault on the now more than 5,000-acre fire.
Tonight there is a battle underway. Brave men and women facing a test of will, courage, and endurance. 17 wildfires.
Officials credit the aerial attack with keeping the fire from spreading.
The Air Force was dropping retardant on this fire on that northern flank all day today, hoping to stop what you're seeing unfold right now.
According to the National Interagency Fire Center, which tracks wildfires across the U.S., 2012 again saw an increase in the average number of acres burned. For residents in western states, that means the loss of homes and businesses. For the rest of us, it means watching gripping images of firefighters battling the blaze on a massive scale. Back in 2009, while wildfires burned in Los Angeles, we spoke with LA Times then media reporter James Rainey about how the wildfires were unfolding for him in his backyard and on his TV screen.
They're really quite majestic. And if you've ever lived through these wildfires, and I've lived through quite a few of them, there's a feeling of a kind of powerlessness that comes over people. And I think the sight of one of these, and in fact, in this fire, we had even a 747 come in and do a couple of spectacular drops of retardant. It's really quite a awe-inspiring thing to see, because these pilots are very skilled too, and they'll swoop in much lower than you want to see a plane that big normally, and they'll, you know, uncork maybe 20,000 gallons of this bright red retardant. It's extremely telegenic.
So are you saying then that it helps relieve that feeling of powerlessness, that it's like, you know, your classic deus ex machina?
It absolutely does. And this is not to say that there's no utility in it at all. I think all the fire professionals would agree there is a time and place for the retardant. And then there are also water drops, which can be quite effective in spots. But what happens in each one of these fires is, as the anxiety level goes up, people start to call their local city councilman or congressperson, and inevitably the one thing that they know to ask for, because they've seen it in every other fire, is an airplane. There have been constant questions over the last few days on LA TV and radio. Where's the super scooper?
And what is that?
The super scooper is a prop plane that comes down every fire season, and it's a brilliant yellow bird, and it can not only drop a pretty large quantity of water, it can scoop water up as it keeps moving, so it can make a lot of cycles to the closest lake or ocean.
Now, in your column, you call the Super Scooper the erstwhile glitter girl of the fire squadron, and you say that firefighters have a name for the plane drops, that they call them CNN drops.
CNN drops, yes, because what happens is these politicians get those phone calls and they may know themselves that the water drops, the retardant drops are only a part of the solution, but they also know that they're getting dozens and maybe hundreds of phone calls. And the easiest thing for someone in political office to do, of course, is to cave in.
Along with wasting resources, are there any cases where fires took longer to put out because the focus was diverted to these some firefighters call political air shows?
One of the things the fire officials told me is, look, the Super Scooper is specifically to drop water, not to drop retardant. And we've just dropped retardant in some of these areas, which doesn't actually put out the fire, but it slows it down, gives the fire crews more time to build these fire lines. They said if we go up and dump water in some of those areas, we're potentially just washing away the retardant that we just dumped there. So we really want to be careful. We don't care that people are upset that they're not seeing the Super Scooper up in the air. We'll put it in where it can be most effective. It was easier in most cases for helicopters to get in and out of there and dump.
So do you think if the reality of using these planes was reported better, that the pressure on politicians to use them would ease up?
Yes. I mean, if they came on every time and reminded you, boy, that looks beautiful, but it might not make nearly as much difference as the 2,000 guys back up in the foothills with their bulldozers and their axes. I think, yes, it would make a difference.
You wrote this week that the coverage was reminiscent of what you called the skewed perspective that we get at the start of a Middle Eastern war.
Yeah, I do think that there is a hope and sort of a dream that we can solve all these problems through technology. And so in those wars, whether it was the first Gulf War or the Iraq War, we'd see those beautiful Pentagon briefings and the bomb would go right down the chimney and eliminate the communication center. Well, we all know in the aftermath that not all the bombs were quite that smart. There always is collateral damage, and that takes on a very human form if you're on the ground with the foot soldiers. And the same way in a fire, these beautiful air shots are one thing, but I think you'd have quite a different perspective of the fire as a reporter if you were down on the ground with these guys in 105-degree heat, carrying 70 pounds of equipment, traipsing through the chaparral here in California.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
In 2009, James Rainey wrote the On the Media column for the LA Times. He's now a political reporter. Okay, now listen. I'm going to ask you to drop everything you're doing and just wire me $2,000. I needed to get access to a vast fortune that's been left to me by a Nigerian prince who just happens to be a distant relative, and I promise that when I get the money, I'll give you a big cut. That's got to work, right? I mean, if it didn't, why would Nigerian prince scam spam clog your inbox year after year? Cormac Hurley at Microsoft Research offers some clues in a paper called Why Do Nigerian Scammers Say They're from Nigeria?
Well, what Cormac Hurley did was envisioned what the scam would be like from the scammer's perspective, and he applied a mathematical tool called signal detection theory to take a look at why it might benefit the scammers to send messages that were so obviously spam.
University of Illinois psychology professor Daniel Simons wrote about Hurley's research in the Wall Street Journal.
The interesting insight is that what the spammers need to do is filter out people who aren't gullible enough. They need to filter out the people who might respond but wouldn't, in the end, send them any money. It takes the scammers quite a bit of time and effort to reel in the suckers. They have to send repeated emails. They have to prolong the scam, making them become more and more comfortable with the idea of wiring large amounts of money to them, and try and limit their time and effort to those people who are most likely to give them money. So one of the best ways to do that is to make the scam obvious enough that anybody who has any ounce of skepticism won't participate. signal detection originally was applied to hearing, right? So can you detect that very faint beep when you go for a hearing test? If your hearing were perfect, you'd say, yeah, I heard the beep every time there was a beep. And you'd say, no, there was no beep every time there wasn't a beep. But it turns out we tend to sometimes think that something is present when it's not, and we sometimes miss something when it's actually there.
And so in the case of these scammers,
the gullible people are the beeps, right? And all the people who respond but never send them money, they're the absence of a beep that they think is a beep. They don't care about beeps that they don't hear because they can send out millions of emails. And if they miss a few targets, so what? What they want to make sure they do is eliminate those cases where they think they've got a sucker and they don't.
So how many people are falling prey?
There's been at least one analysis by a Dutch security firm called Ultrascan that estimates that these advanced fee scams, scams where they try and get you to send some money, in 2009, the estimate was $9.3 billion, and it's increasing.
In 2008, it was $6.3, so that's, a 50% increase?
Yeah, it's a pretty big increase. And the scammers are actually getting more sophisticated. There was a recent article in the Wall Street Journal about targeting lawyers, law firms, with this sort of an advanced fee scam. It's an interesting approach because law firms are used to dealing with potential clients over the internet, and they often act as an intermediary between a client and a larger company that needs to pay them. And these law firms that are sending money are gullible. They're not thinking twice about why they're wiring $500,000 to Hong Kong. They're not thinking twice about checking whether this cashier's check is legitimate, or they're not thinking carefully from the scammer's perspective about how they could pull off the scam. They call the number that was provided by the client rather than calling the bank directly. So these scams are targeting people who maybe are going to be less skeptical because it is exactly the sort of thing they deal with on a day-to-day basis.
There have been a lot of efforts to counter these scams, you know, educating people, tweaking software that can filter or detect the scams. But you and Mr. Hurley suggest that the solution is actually counterintuitive.
Yeah, you might think that the best way to avoid these scams is to educate people so that they don't fall prey to them. And you don't want somebody in your company to fall for this scam. The best thing you can do is educate them so that they don't respond to these emails. But if you want to stop the scammers more broadly, the interesting approach you can take is to reverse the process, increase the noise for them. And it's called scam baiting, where you respond as if you're going to play along, and then you play along as long as you can, but don't actually send in money.
So I have to assume that eventually the Nigerian prince scams are going to go away because every single person will know that it's phony. I have to assume that's why all those penis enlargement ads are no longer in my mailbox.
The scam won't necessarily go away. There are always going to be some gullible people who are new to the internet who haven't really heard of this particular scam before. That's actually a very effective technique for them because it filters out the people who are aware of the scam. And the only people who are going to respond are the people who are unaware of it, and there always are going to be some of them.
Daniel, thank you so much.
Sure thing. My pleasure.
Daniel Simons is a professor in the Department of Psychology and the Beckman Institute for Advanced Science and Technology at the University of Illinois. Back in 1969, to mock the new popularity of poorly written, sexually explicit books, 25 Newsday journalists got together to write the parody, Naked Came the Stranger. It spent 13 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. Many of those readers knew it was a joke and bought it anyway. Others just bought it. Fast forward 43 years.
He eases me toward the bed until I feel it behind my knees. He grabs my hips with both his hands and runs his tongue around my navel, then gently nips his way to my hip bone, then across my belly to my other hip bone. Ah, I groan.
That's an excerpt from 50 Shades of Grey. It's not a parody. It spent 25 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list and has spawned its own parody, The Diamond Club, which is a crowdsourced ebook that's gotten as high as number 4 on iTunes' top 10 paid ebooks list. The book is the brainchild of Brian Brushwood and Justin Young, the hosts of the NSFW Show podcast. Young says he took inspiration from Naked Came the Stranger.
I had just heard about Mike McGrady's passing, who did the Naked Game, the Stranger hoax, and I'm like, well, we can do exactly this. We can write a novel, but we can sort of twist it a little bit. So instead of it being a staff of Newsday writers, we can reflect the modern times and have our audience be our content creators. The main character of Naked Game, the Stranger, sleeps with these very 1960s kind of characters, like a reformed rabbi and a crooner. We'll update that with our own version of trendy topics like vlogger and cupcake artist and fixed gear bicyclist.
Your audience, I guess, ultimately produced a 100,000-word Google Doc. How many people participated and how involved were you?
We don't quite know exactly how many people had some kind of impact on the book. They've all taken this monk-like vow of silence. For me and Brian's involvement, we laid out exactly what the basics of the plot were going to be, which is that there is a woman who builds a big dating site with a super sex-charged Mark Zuckerberg kind of character. In the first chapter, she finds out that he has married somebody behind her back, and then she kind of goes from there on a 250-page sexual odyssey.
Now, you didn't just send the book out into the world and see it climb the charts. You told your audience to buy it and give it great reviews.
Yeah.
So how do we know that this success isn't just a closed loop where the authors are the buyers and that's just it?
Quite simply because we don't have that many fans. You know, we've done things like this before, and really what we expected was for it to hit the top 10 charts, for us to chart somewhere about where we wound up topping off at about 4, and then that would be it. It would drop like a stone. We'd declare victory, and that's what we've done in the past, and that's what we expected to happen here. This did not happen. Another indication that it wasn't just our fans is that initially when we did our first big push, the also bought row on iTunes showed a lot of things that our audience has also bought, including Brian's books. My friend Andrew Main is a self-published thriller author. A lot of his books showed up there. However, what we saw is like a mood ring, it kind of changed from those books by Brian and Andrew and sci-fi and fantasy to a lot of self-published 99-cent ebooks with very romance novel-y kind of names, like, you know, Bear to Him and stuff like that.
We heard a snippet of 50 Shades of Grey. Let's hear a snippet of your crowdsourced book.
Shh, he said. Why don't you come with me back to my restaurant and I'll show you some of my techniques firsthand. His private driver drove us to Alfeo's, his restaurant on the pier. I've always wanted to eat there, but Roman would never take me. Now, it appeared that Alfeo would be taking me in more ways than one.
It's so ridiculous, isn't it?
Is it true you actually haven't read the whole book?
Oh, absolutely. 110% true. I haven't read the whole book.
Why not?
No. Every day, I kind of woke up thinking that this one would just kind of go away and we would all just be happy about the success we had.
In the past, we've covered books that fool people into buying them by masquerading as other books. That we're talking about books with titles like 35 Shades of Grey. That actually exists and it became a bestseller.
Yeah.
This is a little different. The cover suggests 50 Shades of Grey, but this wasn't an attempt to deceive, right? Merely to mock.
There is an element of mockery in there, but really it was kind of an experiment to see what would happen if we completely eliminated character development and we completely eliminated plot, and all we did was just double down on a gigantic Costco-sized helping of banging.
Thank you very much, Justin.
Well, thank you very much, Brooke.
Justin Robert Young is a co-host of the NSFW Show podcast.
The audience were, by the way, very, very excited about the exposure for the book. I told them, listen, like, you know, what could we read on NPR? And they sent me three of them.
I'm ready.
Matilda, the bearded lady, oozed sex. She had all the lovely curves of a beautiful woman and the facial hair. Roman Dial's soft brown hair bobbed back and forth in the golden rays of the San Francisco sun as I accepted his friend request between my alabaster thighs. He set the menu on the table with such precision and gentleness. I couldn't help but look at his large hands. They held signs of work, but were lithe like the wings of a moth.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Bernie Bernstein, with more help from Ariel Stolberg and Lida Martinez, and edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.